This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing out the year with a series of programs paying tribute to Frank Sinatra. He turned 82 this month, as several new books were published about his life, his music, and his sense of style. A couple of years ago, when Sinatra turned 80, his daughter Nancy put together a book commemorating the occasion called Frank Sinatra, an American Legend. We spoke then about her father. I asked her to choose a song her father recorded that has personal significance for her. And she chose this 1944 recording of She's Funny That Way. He used to sing the song for her mother, his first wife. Nancy says many years later, her father said he still thought of her mother when he sang it.
I'm not much to look at, nothing to see, just glad I'm living and happy to be. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way. I can't save a dollar, ain't worth a cent. She'd never holler, she'd live in a tent. I got a woman crazy for me. She's funny that way.
Nancy Sinatra's book came with a CD that included excerpts of Frank Sinatra's early radio broadcasts. I asked her to tell us about his very first radio appearance on the Major Bowes original Amateur Hour, on which Sinatra appeared in 1935 as part of a group named the Hoboken Four.
They were a separate group, the three guys, and I think they were called the Three Flashes. Major Bowes knew they were all from Hoboken, and I guess that was his little brainchild. Or maybe it was just to shorten the time of their performances. I'm not sure why he put them together, but he did, and he named them the Hoboken Four. My dad traveled with them for a while and then began to resent the fact that he ended up as part of this quartet because he had auditioned as a solo artist.
So Major Bowes stuck Sinatra with this trio to form the Hoboken.
Exactly.
Okay. So this is Frank Sinatra's very first radio appearance, 1935, with the Hoboken Four.
Shine and sway your blues, why don't you shine? Start with your shoes, shine each place up, make it look like new.
Boom, 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 boom.
Shine your face up, I want to see you wear a smile as you. Oh, shine your these and those, you'll find everything turn out right fine. Folks will shine up to you, everybody's gonna hide you, do you? You'll make the whole world chocolate drops. Let me hear you shine up to you, everybody's gonna hide you, do you? You'll make the whole world shine.
Shine and sway your bluesy.
Ah.
Shine, start with your shoesy.
Ah.
You'll make the whole world shine.
That's Frank Sinatra's first radio appearance. And my guest is Nancy Sinatra, who's written a new book about her father called Frank Sinatra, an American Legend. Did your father talk with you much about those early days when he was trying to find himself professionally?
He talked a lot about his family in those days. How disappointed they were that he didn't stay in school. He told me a lot about his early jobs, washing dishes, just anything to scrounge up a few pennies. Now, he hates pennies so much, he doesn't even look at them. He ignores them. He puts them away in a jar, gets rid of them immediately.
I want to play another recording from the CD that comes with your new book, Frank Sinatra, an American Legend. And this is the recording of his last broadcast with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra when he's introducing his replacement, Dick Hames. This was recorded in 1942. Let's listen to it.
Folks, this is Frank Sinatra's farewell broadcast with his band. After tonight, he's going to be strictly on his own. And, Frank, I want to tell you that everyone in the band wishes you the best of luck.
Thanks, Mac, and I'd like to say that I'm going to miss all you guys after kicking around for 3 years. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you to meet the boy who's going to take my place as the vocalist with Tommy in the band. He's a fine guy, a wonderful singer, and he was good enough for Harry James and Benny Goodman, and that's really saying plenty. Folks, I'd like you to meet Dick Hames.
Frank, I don't know if anyone can really take your place with this band, but I'm going to be in there trying. You can bet on that. As for you, well, I know that you'll be knocking them dead on your own hook.
So thanks, Dick.
I agree with you there, Dick, and thanks a lot, Dick Hames. Frank, before you hit the road, how about one more song just for Auld Lang Syne?
That's all right with me, Tom. Give me the beat on our arrangement of the song as you, and I'll see what I can do with it.
I hear music when I look at you, a beautiful theme of every dream I ever knew.
Back with Nancy Sinatra, the recording we just heard is featured on a CD that comes with her new book about her father. Did he talk to you much about this period of his life, leaving Tommy Dorsey, or what it was like to be with the big bands?
Yes, we really went into that in depth because a lot of the legend, the negative legend or myth about him has to do with his leaving Dorsey and how he managed to get out of that horrible contract.
What was so bad about the contract?
It was over a third of his income that was sort of held hostage by Tommy Dorsey for the rest of Frank's life, which I thought was just horrendous. And it was handled by, the breaking of the contract was handled by the top agents and lawyers in the business in New York. And but the myth was that that mafia people, I don't even know who they were supposedly, but the myth was that these people went to Tommy Dorsey and made him an offer he couldn't refuse. Mario Puzo told me that he made up that line in The Godfather, that he'd never heard that about my dad or connected with my dad. But now, of course, everybody thinks it's his. The Dorsey contract, according to my dad, was almost impossible to break. So he really had to get some very strong attorneys in there. And what they did was they reminded Tommy Dorsey that he liked broadcasting on NBC, and these people represented NBC. And they said, if you want to continue to work for NBC, you're going to have to let this guy go.
So what was the next step for your father after he left the Dorsey Orchestra?
Well, one of the legendary moments of his life, he went to the Paramount Theater alone, but working for, alone meaning not connected to an orchestra, but working for or with Benny Goodman and his orchestra. And it was total tumult. I mean, the theater just, the way it was described to me was it felt like the theater was just going to come down.
When you were 4 years old, your father, I think he recorded Nancy with a Laughing Face.
Mm-hmm.
And that song, was it what, a present for you for your fourth birthday? Is that?
Oh, I don't know if it was a present. An interesting, sweet sidelight of that is that Jimmy Van Heusen, when I turned 16, he wrote the music for the song. He gave me his rights, his ASCAP rights.
Really?
To the song when I turned 16. Isn't
that
dear?
That really is.
Isn't that adorable? I don't know if it was a gift for me when I was a little girl, but it certainly is a gift for me now. I love hearing it. Whenever I hear it, it brings a lump to my throat, you know. It's very sentimental.
Was it supposed to be about you? I mean, it sounds
yes.
Really like it's a song to a lover than a daughter, but...
No, it was about me, yeah. Lyrics written by Phil Silvers, the wonderful comedic actor who also, by the way, named his daughter Nancy after the song.
Why don't we hear it?
Okay.
If I don't see her each day, I miss her. Gee, what a thrill each time I kiss her. I've got a terrible case on Nancy with a laughing face. She takes the winter and makes it summer. But summer could take some lessons from her. Picture a tomboy in lace. That's Nancy with a laughing face.
How much did you see your father when you were growing up? How much was he actually home?
Not a whole lot. He was really, I liken his work to traveling salesman. You know, he was pretty much a traveling salesman. I heard him on the radio a lot as a little girl. The most normal child part of my childhood was when he was under contract to MGM. And we were living in the San Fernando Valley in California. And we actually got to have dinner together and breakfast together. And that was kind of Father Knows Best time for us.
When your father started having affairs with other women and that was being covered by the press, and your mother was finding out sometimes through press reports about it, what was it like for you in the house?
My mother had a knack, and still has really, of putting forward a happy face. She generally kept that stuff from us. She, after they actually split, when my dad was looking to marry Ava Gardner, I think the reality of it set in, and she could not help but be sad. I mean, it was just too tough for her. So for that period of time, we were sad also, because not because we understood divorce or anything. I mean, Dad, we were used to his being away. Tina never knew him any other way. But because of my mother's sadness, it was not self-indulgent in any way. It was just she couldn't avoid it. I mean, she would have heart palpitations and faint a little, or have what I guess used to be called the vapors. You know, she just couldn't get it together for a while. But life went on. I mean, we still kept our commitments to Brownie Troops or Bluebirds or whatever we were doing at the time, and my brother with his Cub Scouts and all of that stuff, you know. Nothing really changed.
When your parents divorced, was your father still a part of your life, even though he was still on the road a lot and you maybe didn't get to see him very much?
Always. Yeah, always. Again, it didn't change much. It was really like he was still on the road, in a way.
Nancy Sinatra recorded in 1995. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. When I spoke with Nancy Sinatra, we not only talked about her father's career, we talked a bit about her own. She's best known for her hit, These Boots Are Made for Walking, and for her duet with her father, Something Stupid. But her earlier records were bubblegum productions overseen by Annette Funicello's music director. They did okay overseas, but bombed in the States. In fact, her label, Reprise, was getting ready to dump her, even though the label was founded by her father. Reprise was willing to give her one more chance in 1965, and with some help, she changed her image and her luck.
Jimmy Bowen, who was head of A&R at Reprise, put me with a guy named Lee Hazelwood. Lee had approached Jimmy, unbeknownst to me. He said, I can get her a chart record in this country, and if I don't get her a chart record in this country, you can tell me to leave. And he said, I promise a chart record the first time out. And he delivered. It was called So Long, Babe, and it barely made the charts, but it made the charts. During that session, he said to me, you can't sing like Nancy Nice Lady anymore. You have to sing for the truckers. At about this time, I was getting a divorce. My husband decided he didn't want to have children, and I did, and he knew it. So we split. And Lee said to me, you've been married, and now you're divorced, and people know that. So let's lose this virgin image. Let's get rid of it. And we did that, and we lowered the key. We dropped my voice down where it belonged, again, where I was more comfortable early on in the more R&B type things.
Let's hear These Boots Are Made for Walking from a recent collection of your greatest hits on Rhino Records.
Okay.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Nancy Sinatra is my guest. Did your whole image change after this record came out? The way you dressed, what your public persona?
You know, again, timing is everything in life. I had been on tour in Europe. I brought home from Carnaby Street the miniskirt. And I wasn't crazy about the way my legs looked in the miniskirt, so I put on a pair of boots. I wore that around. It became my favorite thing to wear. I wore it to the dance clubs that I went to.
I messed up you right here. Were they white boots?
No, they weren't. Actually, they were kind of a camely brown color.
Uh-huh.
And I people would make fun of me saying, well, what, are you going to play tennis or what? You know, because the miniskirt was not a staple the way it is now. As a matter of fact, it wasn't seen at all, you know?
Now, a little later on, you recorded a duet with your father, Something Stupid. One thing that's always interested me about this record is that it's a song sung from the perspective of two lovers, but you were singing it as father and daughter. Was that a slightly awkward thing to do?
No, it was a very natural thing to do, but the disc jockeys dubbed it the incest song.
Oh, really?
At the time, which... I think probably added to it in a way, you know, it gave them something fun to kid about. Now recording it, there are different ways to love people, I think, you know.
Was it daunting to record a duet with your father, or were you relaxed about it?
I was very relaxed about it. I had a certain number of hits of my own, and the scary part, though, was coming in when at the end of the session that they were doing that night with Jobim.
Oh, that's the date he recorded with Antonio Carlos Jobim.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
It was one of the sessions for that album, the first of their albums.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, coming in with my little, I called us the B team. Coming in with the B team and watching the A team in action, it was enthralling. And I don't like this word, but awesome, you know. And then, of course, the A team moved over and the little B team took over, Lee Hazelwood, Jimmy Bowen, Billy Strange, and our rhythm section. And we cut a number one song.
Yeah, you delivered.
Yeah.
Why don't we hear it? This is my guest, Nancy Sinatra, and her father, Frank Sinatra.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. I can see it in your eyes that you despise the same old lies you heard the night before. Though it's just a line to you, for me it's true and never seemed so right before. I practice every day to find some clever lines to say to make the meaning come through. But then I think I'll wait until the evening gets late and I'm alone with you. The time is right, your perfume fills my head, the stars get red, and oh, the night's so blue. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you.
Our interview with Nancy Sinatra was recorded in 1995. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.